debate it. New York, London, Paris, Munich, everybody talk about
reaching up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
This is Don Fess, and we're reaching up again right now. All together in 204 countries with great in-person guests and music. Occupy Portland was evicted here this weekend from its downtown encampments, mostly peacefully. But Portland's mayor, Sam Adams, encouraged the movement to continue, and continue it will. This winter, we'll be starting a wake-up call for our churches and working to bring spirituality to the Occupy movement. And today, we launch an exciting, continuing series every few weeks called And Justice for All. My guest today is Dr. Mary Gentile, who has developed a curriculum for university business schools and corporations and a book titled Giving Voice to Values. She joins me here in Portland. Mary, here we are. We made it to the DoubleTree Hotel. Well, you were already here, but I kind of ran over from the convention center. First, tell us your background. That led up to the book, and then we'll talk about the book.
Well, sure. Thanks. It's great to meet with you, Don. I came out of my first 10 years of work at Harvard Business School as a faculty member and a researcher there, a case writer there. That's where I really got started with curriculum development, faculty development around leadership and values. I left there in 1995, spent a good number of years doing consulting to business schools around the world. And about 2.5 years, I joined Babson College in Boston, Massachusetts, which is where I'm based now and where the work with Giving Voice to Values is currently housed.
So what made you write a book about this topic and then tell us, of course, what the book's actually about?
Absolutely. Well, Giving Voice to Values actually grew out of a curriculum that I developed. I developed Giving Voice to Values with seed money, venture funding from the Aspen Institute and Yale School of Management. That was maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, and the idea was to create a new and innovative approach to thinking about values-driven leadership, to try and really revamp what we were doing in business education when it came to ethics and values. So I did a good bit of research. I interviewed a lot of managers, everyone from recent MBAs all the way up to CEOs and boards of directors. I looked at their scholarship, and we came up with what I think is an innovative approach. And we developed a curriculum. We made it available online to educators around the world, and the book grew out of that. And basically, the heart of the curriculum, to put it most simply, is we're asking a new question. Instead of asking the question in ethics education and in leadership development programs, instead of asking the question, what is the right thing to do, we say, once you know what you think the right thing to do is, how do you get it done? The reason we shifted that question is not that it's not important to try and figure out what's right. Of course it is. But the fact is that very often people have a pretty good sense of what they think the right thing to do is, and they're just not sure it's feasible to do it in the organizations where they work, especially if they're being pressured by customers or by suppliers or by even by their managers to do something that they feel is inappropriate or even unethical. And so what we tried to do is find people who had found ways to effectively voice and act on their values, and to try and learn from the strategies that they use so that we could teach people tools and give them the opportunity to practice voicing and acting on their values.
Let me go to some basics. When a lot of people think of students going for their MBAs, which this conference has a lot of, obviously, the old model, not for everybody, but I'm generalizing, was let me get my master's in business, let me see what a great position I can get at some corporation, and let me make as much money as possible. And it stopped there, except for some people. This new paradigm, do you think that a lot of young people now are thinking about values?
Actually, I guess I'd answer that in two ways. The first way I'd answer that is yes. In fact, the survey research that's being done with this generation is suggesting that they're very concerned. Obviously, they want to be successful. They want to do well. But they're also very concerned about issues of sustainability, issues of social justice. They're worried about the planet that they're leaving for their children. It's feeling very immediate to them. It's feeling very close to them. There was a survey that was done last year by IBM. IBM does a survey every 2 years of CEOs about their attitudes toward business. Last year, for the first time, they decided, why don't we ask the same questions of current students, business school students? I think they actually were talking to undergraduate business school students in this survey. But what was interesting about what they found is that they found that the students were concerned about the same issues that the CEOs were. These were issues like the rapid growth of technology and the impact it's having on our lives, certainly issues around climate change and the environment, certainly issues about the interdependence or interconnectedness of everything. What was different is that while the CEOs identified these issues as challenges, and globalization was the other big one, the CEOs identified these as challenges, the students identified them as, obviously challenges, but also as simply just part of the world, part of the world they expected to live in, the world they were comfortable with the idea of living in. In other words, what may seem new and challenging and maybe even frightening sometimes to people my age, to this generation, it's the water they swim in. It's what they grew up with. It's what they developed. So on the one hand, I would say, yes, this current generation is concerned about these issues and has this impact. But the other thing I would say is that, I've been in business education now for over 20 years. And although there may not have been quite the outspoken and even entrepreneurial sort of emphasis on issues of the environment and sustainability and social justice, as you might be hearing right now when I was first doing in business schools. But there always was a core cohort of students who were basically saying, yeah, I want to be successful. I want to make a lot of money. But I do intend to build an enterprise. I want to build a sustainable enterprise. I want to build an enterprise that provides jobs. I want to see myself as one of the good guys. They saw business as part of the good guys. And so just because they wanted to do well did not necessarily mean that they did not care about ethics in any sense. In fact, one of the assumptions behind giving voice to values is that if you think of the business world and you think of MBA students, it's kind of a bell curve, and that we kind of would say, at one tail end, there's a group of people who might identify themselves as opportunists, as people who would say, I'll do anything. Values be damned, in order to maximize my material self-interest. And at the other tail, we might have people who call idealists, people who would say, I'll always try and act on my values, regardless of the material self-interest. What we presume, what we premise, is that the majority of the students in a business school are pragmatists, under the bell, and that these are people who would say, sure, I would like to act according to my values, as long as I feel like I have a shot at it, as long as I feel like there's, a chance I can be effective and successful, which is not the same as saying I know I'll win or I know I'll never pay a price, but just because, I want to think that this is not something that's going to be systematically stacked against me. And so if you take that as the majority you're dealing with, then if you focus your educational efforts not on trying to change the opportunists, which I think would be a Sisyphean task, and not necessarily on the idealists who, are kind of already committed. We maybe just want to teach them to be more competent at it. But really focus on the pragmatists and say, we're going to give you the tools, we're going to give you the skills, And importantly, we're going to give you the opportunities to practice, to rehearse, being who you already want to be at your best. And so what you do by doing that then is you give them the option. You make them feel like it's possible to try and behave this way. So, yes, I think this generation is more concerned, but I wouldn't have written off completely the students I was teaching, you know, 20 years ago.
Now, over the last couple of decades, I guess there's been a new term, and but a lot of people probably aren't familiar with it. And I wonder where it fits as part of the whole picture, and that's social entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, social entrepreneurship is a term that gets used increasingly now, and it gets defined differently by different people. I happen to sit at Babson College in Boston, which is the number one school in the world for entrepreneurship. They designed their MBA and their business education undergraduate curriculum around entrepreneurship before it became as popular as it is now. People typically define that as entrepreneurship within the for-profit world. But increasingly, there's been this kind of blurring of the lines between the sectors, between for-profit and non-profit. And increasingly, there are for-profit organizations who try and run themselves with a social mission as well as a profit imperative. There are for-profit organizations that try and run themselves with a triple bottom line, you know, people, planet, profits. And then there are nonprofits who are trying to run their mission-based nonprofit structure, but using a lot of the tools, the skills, the discipline of the market and of business organizations and business management. Social entrepreneurs, depending on who you talk to, can fit into several of those categories. They can be people who are starting a for-profit business that will have a social purpose or a social mission. So maybe they're creating a product that is environmentally sound and resourceful to replace existing products that, you know, are ending up in landfills or something like that. Or they may be nonprofits who are providing a service but trying to do it in a way that they are more sustainable, that they are not continually dependent on individual donors every year, where they create some revenue-producing part of their business, part of their organization that supports their mission. So there's a blurring of those lines, but it certainly is something that I think on both sides reflects the fact that just because you're in business doesn't mean that you don't care about your social context, and just because you're in a nonprofit doesn't mean that you can't think strategically and intelligently about creating sustainable business models.
Reaching Up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
Together we can all make a difference with the
people. Poverty and hunger here and around the world. So much of the suffering and the dying doesn't have to be. Find out about organizations you can support and join with. Click on Do Good at CelebrateRadio.com or OneHeartForKids.com.
Back with Dr. Mary Gentile, giving voice to values.
Now, you mentioned that the triple bottom line. Tell us again
what that is. Yeah. The triple bottom line was a phrase that was coined in the book Cannibals with Forks by John Elkington a number of years ago. But basically, it's the idea of organizations that don't evaluate themselves simply on the economic bottom line, profits and loss and revenue growth, but who also look at the bottom line in terms of how they are affecting the planet, which can mean both minimizing their negative impacts or eliminating their negative impacts. In some cases, it can mean actually creating positive impacts, as in alternative products, as I was talking about. And then their social bottom line, which can have to do with the way they treat their employees, if they source themselves in certain communities, the impact they have on the larger community, whether they are responsible in the way they enter a community and the way they leave a community, issues around equity in terms of compensation, things of that nature.
But these things, I imagine, sometimes become very difficult without mentioning the major corporation that everybody knows. That actually, there are a few of them that that sells goods retail very cheaply, but therefore can't pay their employees all that much.
Right, right, and I think that's absolutely right. That, you know, when you, as soon as you start to go to a triple bottom line or even a double bottom line, you are actually looking at issues that often feel like they're trade-offs. And one of the things that we heard at the keynote speech this morning from the CEO of REI, one of the things that the president at Babson College, Len Schlesinger, often will talk about is the fact that if we look at these issues of social, environmental, and economic as trade-offs exclusively, we actually are limiting our creativity, or we're limiting our innovativeness, and that, in fact, we can't treat them that way if we actually hope to continue to live on this planet, that we can't always trade off the planet for profits. We can't always trade off social equity, especially when you look at what happens. We look around the world right now, and you look at what's happening in communities, both here at home and abroad, where there's been an extended period of people feeling disenfranchised, of people feeling like they have no hope, of people feeling like they have no opportunity to better themselves. So we know that although trade-offs feel like an easier way to think about this, that we actually have to look for new solutions that look at simultaneously addressing these issues and look at ways to optimize all three. Now, it might mean that in the short term, one of them isn't as high as it might have been as the other. But in the long term, we really do need to think about these things in terms of a simultaneous optimization.
I can't resist asking you. I mean, here are all these MBAs and corporate executives and people like yourself gathered in one place, and not far away in Portland, as almost every other city now, is Occupy Portland. Where does that fit in, and what would you like the people who really want to know what's going on outside those demonstrations and inside them, what would you like them to know in terms of how you change things? Mm-hmm. Because they're obviously looking not only at Wall Street but at corporations as the big bad wolf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think everybody has their own theory of change. My theory of change is that we actually need people working within systems to make change, and we also need people working without systems who are kind of knocking on the walls and getting our attention. But I think it's a delicate balance. If you look at the work I've done with Giving Voice to Values, it probably is work that you would characterize as more heavily inside the system. It's how do you work within your job, within your organization, to actually make things move in a positive direction. But I think there's a real value for the people who stand outside, who are getting people's attention, who are shaking them up, who are creating a sense of urgency so that you might be more likely that those of us working inside will get heard. So I think there's a delicate balance there, because if you go too far in only working within the system, you get co-opted. If you go too far in working outside the system, you destroy a lot of the value that you're trying to redistribute. And so I think it's a delicate balance. I think that there's an opportunity for us right now to learn a lot from what is motivating folks on Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Portland, Occupy Oakland, you know, all of the, and overseas. You know, there are the sort of sister demonstrations overseas. I think there's a lot to learn there, but I also think that there's a challenge because, as far as I can tell, and of course this is based on what I can read in the media, which is limited, but as far as I can tell, the message of these groups is still rather inchoate and rather multiple. That people are there for many different reasons, which is true in any demonstration or any kind of movement, but it's so diverse at this point, and the leadership hasn't quite emerged in terms of a message, that I think that there's the opportunity for it to, you know, go awry, to end up with some of those costs and some of the destruction of value that is really just something that I believe they just want redistributed. But, you know, that's a risk that I think you have to take. And I think that the only wasteful part of this kind of initiative is if we don't learn from it. So I think we have to listen.
So in your work, taking all this, the changing mindsets of some MBAs, corporations, mm-hmm. not all, mm-hmm. looking at sustainability and corporate responsibility.
And also, a corporation isn't a single entity. You know, there may be some
right.
people within who feel one way and others, you know, and that can rise and fall, you know, as time goes and as leadership shifts. So it's never easily one way or the other.
Are you optimistic?
Am I optimistic? I'm actually one of those people who believes that the good and the bad are always there, both of them always, and that it's really a choice. It's really a choice of what you want to choose to work with. They're both true. The pessimistic view of the world is quite real, easy to defend. The optimistic view of the world is also, I think, quite real. And I simply find that I get more energy and the ability to get more done if I try and look at the optimistic side. It gives me fuel. But I see it as an act of free will. I see it as a choice. If I were going to say one thing about giving voice to values, we don't say to people, this will always work. We don't say it's ever easy. We simply say it's unequivocally important to try, and that you actually are going to find a source of energy and a source of innovation in your lives, ideas, if you ask the question, what if I were going to act on my values? And that's really all we're doing.
And the whole point really is that it doesn't start with somebody else. It starts with each of us.
It starts with each of us, exactly. If we wait, we're lost.
Okay, if we wait, we're lost. That's something to think about. We thank you very much for being with us today, and where can people find out more about your book? What's your website?
Giving Voice to Values, you can go to the website, which is givingvoicetovaluesthebook.com, and you'll find excerpts and interviews and videos and a way to order the book if you're interested.
Super. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning.
This week, I saw a wonderful and uplifting film about the teachings of Joseph Campbell called Finding Joe. Change and the heroic must start with you and me getting on the road to the heroic. Filmmaker Patrick Solomon will join us soon.
The most important thing that myths teach us is to go beyond the limits of our possibility.
Joseph Campbell was one of the leading mythology experts of all time.
He diagrammed all of our stories.
He found this one story within all the stories that we can relate to, no matter where you come from.
And he called it the hero's journey.
All the heroes, all the villains, they're all in there, because they're all in here. This is where they come from.
In other words, we're not separate from the characters we see in our movies and in our novels. They are us. It's one journey. If this path of the hero's journey is fairly simple, why then is it that everybody isn't living it?
It's very difficult for a person with the media, with advertising. There's no creativity.
You end up on that treadmill and you can't get off.
We are each our own greatest inhibitors.
The one thing that keeps people small is their fears, or as Campbell says, it's their dragons.
It's a beast, it's a monster. I'll never forget seeing the ramp, and this wave of fear just crashed over me.
It's going from an unsatisfying life to a satisfying life by pushing through the scariest things you can imagine.
I think people wake up to the fact that they're the hero of their own life when they get tired of being the victim of it.
This idea that our greatest selves are still hidden and that what we do with our lives is what makes us heroes.
Once I saw what was possible with a skateboard in your hand, I had to keep going. I mean, I just wanted to fly.
This is it. This is what happens when we follow our bliss. Magical things happen that we couldn't have imagined.
Do something that gives you that moment.
And if you can do that, then you can achieve the impossible.
The great obstacle for most of us is ourselves. If we can overcome that basic fear, in Campbell's terms, we can all be heroes.
This is Don Fass. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up. And be sure to tell us where you're listening. Write me at reachinguprradio@gmail.com. reachinguprradio@gmail.com.
This is the Celebrate Radio Network. Radio Network. From Seattle to Paris, Bangkok to Jerusalem.